Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 6, Dhyana Yoga, text 20-23. Well, we'll just read this first verse, otherwise we'll be here for the rest of the time, just reading the verse. Yatro paramite chitam Nirudha yoga sevaya Yatra chaivatmanatmanam Pashanatmani tushiti Sukhamvatyanti kamyatad buddhigrayam atendriyam Veti yatra nachayvayam Sthitas chalati tatvataha Yam labva chapalam labvam manite nadikam tata Yasmin sito nudukena gurunapi vichalyate Tam vidya dukasam yogam viyogam yogasam gitam. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. In the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness, realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth. Upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. Purport. By practice of yoga, one becomes gradually detached from material concepts. This is the primary characteristic of the yoga principle. So that's to be noted, because we're going to read this very long purport. And the long purport, the principle of yoga is to be detached from material concepts. This will be repeated throughout the Bhagavad Gita. For instance, one material concept is... What's one material concept we have? What's that? Are you? Yes, so that's a material concept that we have. Any other material concepts we have? I was wondering who was the enjoyer and control. I thought it was you, but I didn't. I had to get some confirmation. So that's another material concept. We're the enjoyers, we're the controllers, and, well, that's pretty important material concepts. And Ishvara hamaham bhogi saraham balavansaki. After this, one becomes situated in trance, or samadhi, which means that the yogi realizes the supersoul through transcendental mind and intelligence, without any of the misgivings of identifying the self with the supersoul. So primarily, getting free from material concepts means getting out of the material energy, out of the, becoming liberated, nishta. We call that nishta, the beginning of, or Brahma-Bhuta stage. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nishoshiti Nakangshiti Samaksarveshu Bhuteshu Madbhaktim Labhate Param. That when one comes to the Brahma Bhuta stage and realizes that one is a spiritual being, he doesn't lament, nor is he hanker. And he sees all living entities as spiritual beings in relation to Krishna. So that's getting out of the material concept of life. And after that, one enters gradually into trance. That's called Shravana Dasa. First we're hearing about how we're eternal souls and Krishna is God. We're not these bodies. Krishna is the controller. And then Varna Dasa. Gradually accepting it. Actually doing our activities in that consciousness under the direction of Krishna's representatives to please Krishna. That's called Varnasa, to accept those things. Krishna, everything belongs to Krishna. Therefore, I should utilize everything in Krishna's service to please him. That's called Varna Dasa. And then one can enter into Smarnavasta, where actually Shravana, then there's Smarnam. No, actually, there's Smarnam, then there's Dhyana, then there's Dharana, then there's Dharana Anusmriti, and then there's Samadhi. So that's meditation, absorption, constant remembrance, and Samadhi. So yoga, and the yoga practice is a mechanical way of coming to that stage, of getting free from material concepts by ignoring them, principally speaking, just ignoring them, by becoming detached from them, and at the same time, regulating the breathing, concentrating on first the asana, then the breathing, then the detachment, and after the detachment, meditation on the super soul begins by dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. So yoga practice is more or less based on the principles of the Patanjali system. Some unauthorized commentators try to identify the individual soul with the super soul, and the monists think that this to be liberation, but they do not understand the real purpose of the Patanjali system of yoga. There is an acceptance of transcendental pleasure in the Patanjali system, but the monists do not accept this transcendental pleasure out of fear of jeopardizing the theory of oneness. Patanjali Yoga Sutras are quite popular nowadays. Many people give their commentaries. Has anyone ever read the Patanjali Yoga Sutras? 50% of your life is wasted. If you can understand it, you're doing pretty well. There's so many interpretations. They're sutras, so they're subject to interpretation. And since there's probably no one actually practicing yoga in this age, they're subjected to what we can say is simply speculation. But, for instance, they have this word, niyama. Niyama is called Ishvara Pradana, worship of the Supreme Lord. Now, 99.9% of the commentators on the Patanjali Yoga Sutras are impersonalists, so they don't like that one. So they interpret it in any way they like, concentrating on the self within yourself, Ishvara Pradana. Then they have other things like there is Asteya, and one of them is Brahmacharya, celibacy. They don't like that one either. They interpret it in so many different ways. And the more impersonal you get, the more distorted it becomes. But none of these commentators, maybe there's a devotee who commentated on it, they're all impersonalists. But here it mentions about transcendental pleasure. So transcendental pleasure must be the dualists that don't like the idea that there is such a thing as transcendental pleasure. Because that means that there's something, beyond what we're, let's go into it. The duality of knowledge and knower is not accepted by the non-dualists. But in this verse, transcendental pleasure realized through transcendental senses is accepted, and this is corroborated by Patanjali Muni, the famous exponent of the yoga system. The great sage declares in his Yoga Sutras 3.34, Purushartha Shunyanam Gunanam Prati Prasava Kaivalya Srupa Pratishtava Chiti Shakti Iti. This Chiti Shakti or internal potency is transcendental. So that means that there's two things. There must be internal energy and external energy. But they don't believe that there are two things. There's only supposed to be one. Now, Sankaracharya says, Narayana Puro Vyakta, and Prabhupada quotes that many times, that Narayan is above the material energy. But for the impersonalists, that's not a big credit to Narayan, because they believe from reality, which is Brahman, which is oneness, for some reason, Brahman got a little bored one day and decided to create Narayan, who really doesn't exist. So for Narayan, who's just an illusion, they decided to create, he was inspired by the being an illusion, he decided to create more illusion. So here we are. From Brahman, created some illusion, created Narayan, and Narayan created a bigger illusion, or another illusion, which we're going through. So if you don't understand that, that's good. And if you think you understand it, you're in the wrong place. The great say, this chit shakti or internal potency is transcendental. Purushartha means marginal religiosity, economic development, sense gratification. At the end, the attempt to become one with the Supreme. This oneness with the Supreme is called Kaivalya by the monists. According to Patanjali, this Kaivalya is an internal or transcendental potency by which the living entity becomes aware of his constitutional position. In other words, they would like Patanjali to be an impersonalist. As a matter of fact, generally that's how they interpret it, everything that he's saying. But the Vaishnavas can see that he was actually a devotee. But according to, in other words, in the words of Lord Chaitanya, this state of affairs is called Cheto Darpana Marginam, or clearance of the impure mirror of the mind. This clearance is actually liberation, or Bhava Mahadevagni Nirvapana. The theory of Nirvana, also preliminary, corresponds with this principle. In the Bhagavatam 2.10.6, this is called Srupena Vyavastiti. The Bhagavad Gita also confirms this situation in this verse. In other words, Patanjali says that we're all eternal souls, and that there's a supreme soul, and that when we wipe the mirror of our mind, then we can actually see who we are, and we can see who the Supreme is, and we become ecstatic. We experience transcendental pleasure. The monists say we merge into the Supreme. But Patanjali says, no, we don't merge into the Supreme. We become aware of the Supreme, and then we become blissful. That the Supreme is the source of pleasure, and that when we become aware of him, we become blissful. We don't merge into him. After nirvana or material succession, there is the manifestation of spiritual activities. So the impersonalists say everything ends at the time of liberation. Our identity ends, and therefore we don't do anything. We just exist. And here it says, after nirvana, then actual life begins again. In the words of the Bhagavatam, Surupena Vyavyastiti, this is the real life of the living entity. Maya or illusion is the condition of spiritual life contaminated by material infection. Liberation from this material infection does not mean destruction of the original eternal position of the living entity. Patanjali also accepts this by those words, Kaivalya Surupa Pratishta Va Chiti Shakti Iti. This chiti, shakti, or transcendental pleasure is real life. This is confirmed in the Vedanta Sutra as Ananda Maya Vyasa. This natural transcendental pleasure is the ultimate goal of yoga and is easily achieved by execution of devotional service or bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga will be visibly described in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. In the yoga system, as described in this chapter, there are two kinds of samadhi, called sampragyata samadhi and asampragyata samadhi. When one becomes situated in the transcendental position, by various philosophical researches, he is said to have achieved sampragyata samadhi. In the asampragyata samadhi, there is no longer any connection with mundane pleasure, but then one is transcendental to all sorts of happiness derived from the senses. When the yogi is at once situated in that transcendental position, he is never shaken from it. And thus the yogi is able to reach this position, he is unsuccessful. So the idea is that one actually withdraws his consciousness away from the material energy and focuses it upon Krishna, one becomes blissful. And then he's no longer attracted by the material energy, because there's really no bliss in the material energy. And until one comes to that point of experiencing transcendental pleasure, then there's always the danger of falling down. Because the soul, actually, he lives for pleasure. Because that's his nature. Krishna lives for pleasure. Ananda, he does everything for pleasure. We also do everything for pleasure. But here, pleasure means avoiding things which would cause us unpleasure or displeasure, and trying to do things that we think will give us pleasure. But in the spiritual world, everything gives pleasure, because it's all based upon love. So when one becomes aware of Krishna, and the pleasure there becomes anandamaya abhyasa, or becomes ananda buddhivardhanam, then when one is no longer attracted by material sense pleasure, and therefore one is free. Till one comes to that platform, then there's every possibility of being attracted by the illusory energy, especially because of the state of forgetfulness. Even we experience great transcendental happiness, unless it's continuous, then that means we're in a state of forgetfulness. And if we're in a state of forgetfulness, we may become curious about trying out other kinds of happiness and see what we can get from them, because we forget. Like Daksha, when he got his head cut off and he became a goat. He got the head of a goat. He didn't last very long as a goat. And therefore he took birth again in another Manvantara as Daksha again. But his service is to be a Prajapati. So he had to pray to Vishnu to get the potency to become a Prajapati again. After offering very elaborate prayers, then Vishnu came on his Garuda. And Daksha was so much in ecstasy that, practically speaking, he had to sit on the ground. He couldn't stand, he was so in ecstasy. And then Vishnu said, "Yes, I've come here. What can I do for you?" He said, "Well, actually, I just want, if you can benedict me with unlimited sex life, so be it." Then he left. Now, it's almost inconceivable, you're experiencing so much happiness you can't even stand, and then what do you ask for? Some mundane pleasure. And of course, he wasn't asking for mundane pleasure. He was trying to do his duty, what he thought was his duty, and his duty was to expand the population of the universe. Therefore, he didn't get sufficient intelligence to ask for pure love of God, and maybe a little extra potency to do his duty. Because he didn't have the proper association. Today's so-called yoga practice, which involves various sense pleasures, is contradictory. A yogi indulging in sex and intoxication is a mockery. Even those yogis who are attracted by the city's perfections in the process of yoga are not perfectly situated. If yogis are attracted by the byproducts of yoga, then they cannot attain the stage of perfection as stated in this verse. Persons therefore indulging in the make show of practice of gymnastic feats or cities should know that the aim of yoga is lost in that way. So you can't light a fire and pour water on it at the same time. So trying to achieve sense pleasure at the same time try to meditate on Vishnu, on Krishna, in any way is impossible, because that's how the material nature works. As soon as we contemplate the objects of the senses, the illusory energy, which is stronger than us, will act sequentially. Lust, greed, anger, delusion, forgetfulness, and our intelligence is swept away, like a boat on the water is swept away by a strong wind. So even one of the roaming senses, in which the mind becomes fixed, can carry away the man's intelligence. So any attraction to material sense happiness, mental speculation, will carry away our intelligence. And then there's no question of becoming conscious of Krishna. On the other hand, if we become conscious of Krishna, then we'll no longer be attracted to these temporary material experiences. The best practice of yoga in this age is Krishna consciousness, which is now baffling. Krishna conscious person is so happy in his occupation, he does not aspire after any other happiness. So baffling means that even great yogis like Vishwamrita Muni, who meditated for thousands of years, tens and thousands of years, just a little attraction to sense pleasure, and immediately he forgot for 100 years what he was doing. That's called baffling. I mean, that's quite a long time to forget. Oh, that's right. 100 years have gone by and I forgot. Oh yeah, I was supposed to be meditating. That's right. On Vishnu. Oh, right. Back to it. Ah. Hare Krishna. Luckily we only forget, for a much shorter period of time. The best practice of yoga in this age is Krishna consciousness, which is not baffling. A Krishna conscious person is so happy in his occupation that he does not aspire after any other happiness. There are many impediments, especially in this age of hypocrisy, to practicing Hatha Yoga, Dhyana Yoga, and Jnana Yoga, but there's no such problem in executing Karma Yoga or Bhakti Yoga. As long as the material body exists, one has to meet the demands of the body, namely eating, sleeping, defending, and mating. But a person who is in pure bhakti yoga or in Krishna consciousness does not arouse the senses while meeting the demands of the body. Rather, he accepts the bare necessities of life, making the best use of a bad bargain, and enjoys transcendental happiness in Krishna consciousness. He is callous towards material incidental occurrences such as accidents, disease, scarcity, and even the death of a most dear relative. But he is always alert to execute his duties in Krishna consciousness or bhakti yoga. Accidents never deviate him from his duty. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, agama payano nityas tam titikshas vibharata. He endures all such incidental occurrences because he knows that they come and go and do not affect his duties. This way he achieves the highest perfection in yoga practice. So again, basically speaking, the yoga system is meant for the same thing we're trying to do when we're chanting japa. It's just easier to chant japa than the yoga system, because by chanting japa and just listening itself without doing anything else, it means we're already at the stage of yama, niyama, asana, pranayama and pratyahara. Because all the thing is just to detach myself from material conceptions, which in our case are material thoughts. Because we have so many material conceptions. We have our main material conceptions are that I'm this body and that I'm the joyer and the controller. But that's just subsets of hankering, lamentation, and fighting with others. In other words, if we simply become detached from these subsets, all these thoughts, which are just byproducts of our material concept of life, namely hankering, lamenting, and getting, having different kinds of relationships, mundane conceptions of others, then the result is that gradually our mind becomes clarified, and then we can see ourselves and we can see the super soul. In other words, when we actually become detached from these thoughts and chant Hare Krishna in a humble state of mind, thinking oneself, etc., etc., when we chant with a proper attitude, then gradually we come to the platform of actually experiencing Krishna more, the holy name more. In other words, we actually start realizing that there is the holy name and that Krishna and his name are non-different. Then, as we experience that, then nadanamna janamna sundarim, then we don't need all these material things. When we develop the proper attitude, then our material desires go down, and we don't need all these things to protect ourselves. Then, we can actually understand that we're Krishna's eternal servants, and aspire after that. And then as we become deeper into our consciousness of Krishna, remembering Krishna, and experiencing Krishna, we feel some experience of love and separation. And when that becomes perfect, then we become a pure devotee of Krishna. And we can meditate it on trance. So, just chanting and listening, chanting nicely, and then listening nicely to what we're, how we're chanting, brings us to the stage which we see people practicing for so many years, and they don't even know they're supposed to become detached from the material minds. They do pranayama, and they become detached a little bit, and they get up, and they do the same thing they were doing before. In other words, they're just like the elephant bathing, partially bathing, and then getting on the land, throwing all dirt all over it all again. Because we do the same thing, but since we're, our objective is, we're starting with Krishna, and Krishna, if we actually sincerely chant to Krishna, Krishna purifies us by his presence, by becoming conscious of Krishna, and therefore we start more or less where we left off. If we didn't throw too much dirt over our bodies during the day, then we start where we left off, and we can try to chant, and we gradually, then we can learn how to chant better. And as we get better, then remembrance of Krishna comes more spontaneously, experience of Krishna becomes more spontaneously, and therefore gradually we become actually detached from material conceptions, material desires, and we become interested in becoming ever more aware of the holy names, their names, form, quality, and pastimes of Krishna. And then our lives become Krishna conscious. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Or if you don't like that, go ahead. Then you can always sit down and try to do the Ashtanga Yoga system. And if you don't make it in this lifetime, maybe next Satya Yoga you should become. Yes.
Hare Krishna. I didn't quite grasp the when Prabhupada was saying in the purport how the monist philosophy is jeopardized by idea of transcendental pleasure. Why? How?
Well, there's someone who has pleasure, and there's us. Now, if we're all one, if I become blissful, why don't you also become blissful? When I become liberated, why don't you become liberated too? We're just the same. Can you explain that? If everything is one, if you and I are the same, then when I become liberated, why don't you become liberated? When I become blissful, why don't you become blissful? And where do we get the bliss from? If we're not blissful now, why do we become blissful later?
So they just want to be okay with the terms in which they are now.
No, they want to... I mean, I can't understand personal philosophy. It's just ridiculous. Because, first of all, it's based upon Sanskrit. Word juggling is Sanskrit. So, it's really... They just fight it out on the intellectual, logical platform. It has nothing to do with any real experience. Of course, they try to merge in Brahman, try to still the mind, because they think that there's only one reality, which is Brahman, but somehow or another they've juggled words around to say that actually we're really not an illusion, because illusion is just illusion. So we're really not an illusion, but we have to realize we're not an illusion. So it makes no sense. But if you dedicate, if you're in the absence of real knowledge, Krishna consciousness, in the absence of, then ignorance seems pretty good. And if you study Sanskrit long enough and you're attracted to word jugglery, then you could actually become convinced. And of course they go through austerity to realize that they're Brahman. Makes no sense, because if they're actually God, then how could they be an illusion? That makes illusion greater than God. How can illusion put God? Illusion must be supreme. But if illusion is supreme, greater than God, then illusion is God. And since we're supposed to be God, but we're under illusion, then we're not God. Illusion is God. But then illusion is greater than us, so there's a duality. There's illusion, there's us. Doesn't make any sense, does it? No, even if you accept illusion as God, then we're not God. But there's a duality. There's illusion, and then there's us as God. But we're not God. Illusion is God. We're being controlled by illusion, then we're not God. We're just servants of God, servants of illusion, which is our philosophy also. So in our present state, we're just servants of illusion. The most obvious thing, we agree with them, but they don't seem to understand that if they're an illusion, then their illusion is greater than they are. Now, to get out of illusion, they have to follow Krishna's teachings. So they follow Krishna's teachings in the Bhagavad Gita or in the Bhagavatam, whatever. So that means that Krishna must be no more than they do in order to get out of illusion. So Krishna must be above illusion. So they think that they're the same as Krishna. But according to their philosophy, Krishna is a product of illusion too. But if Krishna is a product of illusion, then illusion is above Krishna. So how can Krishna tell us to get out of illusion when he's also an illusion? He's just a product of illusion. So the more you get into it, if you keep a sane mind, you can see they're just wasting their time. It's just out of envy, envious of Krishna, that Krishna is giving them such distorted intelligence. And therefore one can just put it aside. As far as transcendental pleasure, well, transcendental pleasure frees one from illusion. But where does it come from? It has to come from someone who's not an illusion. Because if they have transcendental pleasure, which frees one from illusion, then that person with transcendental pleasure must be above illusion. So he must be greater than illusion, but we're under illusion. So we're subordinate to illusion, and illusion is subordinate to him. Is that clear? No? In other words, if by transcendental pleasure, if you become aware of transcendental pleasure when you get out of illusion, that means that in the absence of illusion, there's transcendental pleasure. And that's coming from the supersoul, because that's where they get it from. That means that the supersoul is above illusion. Because if he was an illusion, he wouldn't be experiencing it. He wouldn't be giving you transcendental pleasure. When we're an illusion, we don't experience transcendental pleasure. So the transcendental pleasure is not coming from us, it's coming when we become free from illusion. So the person who's giving us the transcendental pleasure can't be an illusion, otherwise we also be experiencing transcendental pleasure, even an illusion. But it's when we get out of illusion that we experience transcendental pleasure, but that comes from the supersoul. So he's above the illusion, and we're under illusion. So there's three things. There's the super soul, there's ourselves, and there's illusion. So it's not all one. Is that clear? Yes. It's actually quite simple, but if you study Sanskrit enough and you associate with the Mayavadis, then it becomes all very complicated.
Hare Krishna, I have two questions, but I'll start with one.
No, but it's all one. Why make it two?
They are not connected, really.
Oh.
In commentary, our Acharya equates bhakti yoga with karma yoga. Somehow, is somehow puzzling, appearing that equation in that part which speaks about meditation and so on, but says also something about his understanding of bhakti yoga, that we should do something probably, or what do you think, why is that in the commentary?
Well, there's the Prabhupada writes different things about karma yoga. The sixth chapter of karma yoga, there's a little detachment and there's a little bit of knowledge. And in the ninth, tenth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, karma yoga is defined as when one knows that the goal is Krishna, but when one is attached to the results of his activities, he's said to be acting karma yoga. But for ourselves, we're not only doing karma yoga, we also have an aspect of jnana yoga, and even astanga yoga. But we're actively engaged in Krishna service. So, Prabhupada equates bhakti yoga with karma yoga, because we're doing things, but we're doing them for Krishna, and our idea of karma yoga is we do things with Krishna, in Krishna consciousness. So in the fifth chapter is called karma yoga, action in Krishna consciousness, not just karma yoga. So when we're referring to karma yoga, it's not just karma yoga, it's activities in Krishna consciousness also. It's not just plain karma yoga. Therefore, they go into this whole thing about the what are those different types of karma yoga? There's jnana. No, what was the jnana midra bhakti? And then what was the other one? Sakarma karma yoga and nishkam karma yoga. So the different, when Prabhupada is referring to karma yoga, he's really referring to the. And bhakti yoga is the same, I guess, up to this above nishkam karma yoga. Karma yoga without material desire, not karma yoga with material desire. Therefore, you'll find that in the, there's a whole division of karma yoga that, in a division where they divide up, there are two, I think it's in the seventh chapter, there are two types of transcendentalists, those who are living entities, those who are engaged in karma, in transcendental life, and those who are actually in material life, like animals. And then he divides it further, those who are transcendentalists, then some of them attached to the results of the work, and some of them are not attached to the result. And those who are not attached to the work, then those who are seeking after the heavenly planets, or merging Brahman, are really not seeking the real auspicious path, but those who are trying to reach the Supreme, they're actually in this auspicious path. So, when he's referring to karma yoga, it's not ordinary karma yoga, it's karma yoga in Krishna consciousness. Is that clear? Yeah. Just that Prabhupada doesn't get into all the details of all these, as some of our devotees do, which is not bad, into all the details of the Sanskrit, because he's trying to make it as simple as possible. But it could become confusing, because karma yoga is used in different ways in the purports. Yes?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. You mentioned Daksha praying to Vishnu and getting his darshan and then asking for being a very good Prajapati. So this is often quite surprising that they directly see the Lord, the Supreme Lord. They have chanted some very pure prayer, and they see the Lord directly. And it seems that sometimes they do not decide to accept the path of pure bhakti, do not value the path of pure bhakti. So how does it happen that they see the Lord directly in front of them? They have chanted wonderful prayers.
Because I guess whatever our motivation is when we start to do something, we wind up getting that result. So if our motivation is to get something from Krishna, then we wind up getting it. And by the illusory energy of Krishna, we forget, actually. It only takes a moment to forget what would just happen. Because we're so determined. Because everyone thinks that the goal that the material energy puts in front of us, if we get that, that will make us happier than anything. And when we asked for benediction, when our daksha was there, even though Krishna was there, obviously he just forgot. He just wanted to get his benediction. The other thing is that even daksha, was a great Prajapati, but he didn't really take advantage of being Brahma's son like Narada Muni did, who was a transcendentalist, and inquire from him about spiritual life. So he was absorbed in material life. So even if he was in ecstasy from Vishnu's association, it was just part of his being empowered for his material enjoyment, or his material duty, we could say. He wasn't praying for material enjoyment. He was praying for doing his duty. So if he got somehow or another empowered in some way or another to do it, he was happy. I mean, we have that. We can be in ecstasy at one moment, then the next moment we completely forget it. He's not a pure devotee, daksha. And therefore, he's subject to forgetfulness from one moment to the next. Anything else? Did you have a second question? We don't believe it's all one. If you ask one question, you ask all of them.
Why is this great warning from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu about being in contact with Mayavada if it has no appeal, or why is it appealing to us?
Well, obviously it appeals to us because we've been in contact with Mayavadi since time immemorial. It's to the pure devotees he warns, for those who are aspiring to become devotees. What's the appeal? I don't know why we're here around here. Because the appeal is we want to become God. We think God, I mean, look at Krishna in the spiritual world, how much he's enjoying. If we could become God, it would be quite, you know, we think it would be quite wonderful. Although we wouldn't know what to do. I mean, it'd be hard to be in every atom and try and figure out. But we imagine it would be great. Because Krishna is enjoying a lot. We think we can take his position. Matter of fact, we think about everyone. We're not only envious of Krishna, we're envious of everyone. And because we're envious of Krishna and envious of everyone, therefore we want to take everyone's position. Therefore, the beginning of human life is to do one's duty. And then gradually that tendency will go away. Find out what one's spiritual duty is and to do it. And gradually that tendency will go away. Then we'll find out what's so attractive about it. Ultimately, when Gop Kumar got to the final covering of the universe, he not only went through the universe and became Brahma for a while, and then the Vriha Bhagavatamrita, and finally he made it out into the coverings. And there were incarnations and opulences greater than anything in the material world, in the material universe. And he went through a successive state coverings, and they're quite large. You take a dot and you draw it 40 kilometers away. That dot is our inside of our universe, and the coverings represent 40 kilometers away, much bigger than this little dot of universe. He went through them successively, and Maya came and offered him successfully greater opulences in every covering. And finally, he got to the final covering, and Maya came herself as sex personified, telling him she wanted him to stay there and enjoy with her. So that's what it's all about. That we're going to be Radha or Krishna. Just being God would be pretty boring. But to have your own, you know, energy of enjoyment, your goddess of Lakshmi, or Radharani to enjoy with you, that's what the whole thing is about. Imitating Radha and Krishna. Alright, thank you very much. Grandharaj Bhagavad Gita.